Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to PensionBee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Akima Paul Lambert. Akima is a Cambridge graduate, a partner at Hogan Lovells, a diversity, equity and inclusion champion, and she is also the former diplomatic ambassador to her native country, Grenada. Akima, thank you so much for being here today. Can you introduce yourself in more detail for the benefit of the listeners?
Thank you so much, Davinia. I am delighted to appear on your podcast. I am a big fan. I've listened to quite a few episodes and I absolutely love the work that you're doing in relation to pay equity. So I am so proud to be here. So how would I describe myself? I am a Caribbean woman. I was born in Grenada. I moved here to the UK when I was 17 years old to go to Cambridge, but at its heart, I still consider myself to be a Caribbean woman. Very early on, I was a CARICOM Youth Ambassador, and I think that imbued a love of development and economics in me. Trained as a lawyer in the UK and in the US, and subsequently worked with a number of international firms. I'm now back at the firm that I trained at. I'm an avid reader. I have two children, a son who's 6 and a daughter who's 2. And I'm married to my husband, Sean, who's also from Grenada. Well picked there. And he's a GP. So that's a little more insight about me. I love talking about issues that affect women. I love talking about issues that affect Caribbean women. I love talking about issues that affect women with children, because I sit at the intersection of many of these identities as a woman from the global south, who continues to experience a lot of the issues faced by women of the global south. So yeah, it's a delight to be here on this podcast.
Akima, thank you so much. I mean, we're going to unpack lots of what you've just shared over the course of this conversation, so I'm really excited to be getting into it with you. One of the things that it strikes me with you in particular, I mean, you've got an incredible microblog series, as I refer to it, on LinkedIn. And actually, you are one of few reasons for me in even logging on to LinkedIn, because I have to say, I find it really noisy at times.
That is really nice to say.
No, it's a big deal. It's a big deal because I do find lots of these platforms noisy and busy. And that I can find quite overwhelming at times. But because I don't know how I've done it, but invariably I'll log on to LinkedIn for my weekly check-in and I'll see a thought or a musing from you at the top of my feed. And you give your perspectives on a multitude of different topics. And the underlying theme across many of them is social mobility, as well as, you know, womanhood, what it means to be authentic, what it means to progress in your career, in life in general. And you shared one quite recently, actually, that really resonated. You know, for lots of people listening, we're on the cusp of summer holidays, which strikes real fear into the hearts of many, not least women.
Absolutely.
You know, we're staring down the barrels of 6 weeks worth of holiday in which, you know, for working parents, we're thinking, you know, how on earth do we occupy these children? And if we do occupy these children, at what cost? And so you shared a post on that. Just in your view, I suppose my first question is, how did that come about? Where did you get the inspiration for it? Because one of the things that you didn't say in your introduction is that you are such a creative woman as well. You know, you write poetry, and you know, you can see that coming through, right? It comes through in your musings.
That is true. That is true. I'm an aborted writer.
Yeah, and an incredible
one. Oh, thank you. But I've always been a writer. I think at my heart, I am a creative. And I think it's that creative expression that makes me a good lawyer, because invariably, I think I'm very good. You know, I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm bad at. I think I'm good at drafting. I think I'm good at presenting and good at my advocacy. And I think those are some of the skill sets that I borrow from my creative arsenal that makes me into the lawyer that I am. But yeah, I have a creative background. I wrote poetry all my life. I'm an avid reader. I read probably about 3 or 4 books every week, just on the way to work. And a lot of what I write comes from a lot of what I ingest. I think good stuff in, good stuff out, bad stuff in, bad stuff out. So I'm never one, you know, who would write and not ingest. I think it's very important to ingest before spitting out. I was a Calypsonian as well for a number of years. I took part in the Calypso competition in Grenada and in London for quite a long time.
And for those people that are unfamiliar, what does that, because that is a big deal in Caribbean culture, being a Calypsonian, it's a really important part of our heritage and our history. And one of the ways through which we are able to express all of the different strands of our being, you know, the social issues of the day quite often are communicated through song and through performance, through poetry. So what does that mean for you and your identity?
Yeah, so my family members were involved in Calypso. My uncle was a Calypsonian. And as you say, it's, you know, it's a form of social commentary, political commentary. So I would pen these Calypsos myself. And I was one of the youngest children. Usually adults would pen them for children. And when I started singing, I really wanted to do it myself. So I joined a few Calypso workshops. I would pen them myself. I would come up with a theme. The presentation is based on satire. It's based on a lot of double entendre and double meaning. So the wordplay was great for me as a creative person. And yeah, I ended up winning, you know, my junior Calypso Monarch, which is the prize for the top junior Calypsonian. Won the women's prize as well, won the independence prize. I think I won every single Calypso crown in Grenada, including the national prize. And then when I came to London, I took part in the competition and I won, and then won an extempo competition as well. So I was quite deep into the creative aspects of things. You know, I've always been, I would say, you know, a sort of hyphenate. Before it became, you know, a slashy, as they now call it. You know, I do a number of things, all in the creative sphere, you know. So you would usually find me doing poetry, doing a bit of singing, doing a bit of calypso, doing a bit of writing. And I think that's complementary, you know, that's, you know, it's a great outlet. And as I say, I think it cross-pollinates and infects a lot of what I do. I can often think of things in a creative way or in a way that is atypical in my job. And I think that has to do with how I express myself.
Yeah, no, I love that. And then you can see, you know, with regard to how that spills over into the professional realm and thinking about, you know, as I say, some of the thoughts, some of the perspectives that you're able to share with people. I know you have your Friday post, sometimes it's a Sunday post, but whatever the case, whatever the day, you know, you make it work and you share very, very candidly your perspectives on all of these different issues. So where does the inspiration for that come from?
I think the inspiration comes from, you know, what is my wider purpose? We can probably tie it back to, you know, making it rain. I've never been a person, you know, like a lot of women, I've always focused on community building. Since I was a child, I was always involved in Friends of the Earth. I was involved in, long before the environment was something sexy, you know, that was my thing, you know, climate change, you know, writing on issues, joining development committees, things like that. So I've never been a person that has been particularly motivated by, you know, money. I think that comes from that place. You know, I'm motivated by a number of different things: purpose, community, philosophy, you know, thinking. That is probably where it comes from, because I see my goal as a law firm partner in the city. You don't often see faces like mine. I think it would be a real shame and a travesty if I did not impart, you know, some of what I've learned, if I did not change, or at least contribute, or at least try to change the places where I am for the better. And if I did not use my profile to assist my community, whether it's my community of women, whether it's my community of Black lawyers, whether it's my community of Caribbean people. So I think I've always been motivated by that. And that is probably what that is what really drives me to share quite so much. Because when I was coming up, you know, people did not. And I don't think that it has helped our respective communities. I think being closed and not learning from experience has actually hampered people who sit on the edges, or who are minoritized, or who do not belong to the dominant class. So I think it's so important for us to have our voices heard.
I love that, Akima. And you're quite right. It's something that, it's a perspective that we share, in that I have always been a big believer in and champion of us embracing our differences, amplifying those differences, also amplifying, you know, the things that we have in common, because I think that's important too. We don't want to live in silos or ghettos away from one another. But at the same time, I think certainly in previous generations, and of course, ultimately, the prevailing consensus is led by what you have to do to survive, you know, and the conditions within which you operate and where you feel, how you can achieve psychological safety, physical safety in some respects, and, you know, that emotional comfort. But I think you're quite right. You know, we would do ourselves a disservice by not showcasing some of the things that differentiate us, but which we have in common, as I say, because then what we want to do is to normalize these differences for new people that are coming in, exactly as you described, who maybe sit on the fringes, who maybe feel marginalized, excluded, etc. And it's very, I mean, the reason, of course, you know, given the work that I do with Raincheck, it's absolutely a part of that. You know, in thinking about financial inclusion, how can women have a seat at the table, have a voice, but also really feel that they are economic participants in the society and the communities within which they live, and which they've already been doing. But it's just been that contribution has been hidden, it's been buried, and it hasn't been given the same respect as it should have been given. So, I mean, one of the things that I've always loved about everything that you share is that you are so candid about the ways in which you've been othered in a variety of different realms, you know, whether it's your accent, your hair, ethnicity, or nationality. But the thing that always, it always tickles me, it makes me laugh, is that you've talked about, you shared in a recent post that you didn't necessarily even describe yourself as Black. You wouldn't have thought of yourself as Black per se, as, you know, as a characteristic, until you moved to the UK. And I've heard somebody else, I've heard a prominent writer talking about this same subject.
I think it was Chimamanda. She said that probably, as well. Yes. Until she got to America, because it isn't a thing, you know. Like, if you're in a majority Black country, you don't go around describing yourself as Black. Everybody yes. is Black. Well, and there's a nuance, because we do have, you know, people of Southeast Asian origins. Mm-hmm. And we absolutely. Have, you know, different races in the Caribbean, but they would probably describe themselves by their physical characteristics. I would have never walked around saying I'm a Akima Paul Lambert, I'm a Akima Paul, and I'm a Black woman. You know, we learned about being Black, you know, we learned about the civil rights struggles. And that's not to say race didn't exist. That's not to say racism or, you know, colorism and other genres, subgenres didn't exist. but it didn't magnify itself in a way that was so apparent. It was probably more hidden. So I never had to confront directly the reality of it until I moved to the UK. So that's what I really meant, you know, and I say it tongue in cheek because obviously I'm a black woman.
Yes.
But I never thought of myself, you know, and sometimes you hold the mirror, there's a dual realities. How do you see yourself and how do other people see you? And it was that realization of coming to see myself in the way that other people saw me. Whereas when I was growing up as a child in the Caribbean, I was not seen as that, you know. You see and, you know, it's almost, you know, I think, therefore I am. You see and therefore I am. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting observation and I'm definitely not the first to feel like that. It's one that, you know, you have to come to terms with. And increasingly, you learn, how do I see myself? That's what matters, not necessarily how others see me.
Right. I mean, prior to me hitting record, we were talking about confidence and your inherent confidence, your self-belief, and the fact that through positive reinforcement, affirmation, but also the fact that the expectations of you were so high, and that was your normal, that when you enter spaces, quite often you'll receive feedback that says, you know, you carry yourself with such confidence, but for you, that is just your normal.
That is true. And I don't even see it as confidence. And as a matter of fact, I notice when people are tentative because when, you know, I didn't come from a privileged background. And I think here confidence is associated with privilege. And that is one of the issues that we face, that when we don't encourage working class children to be confident because it's seen as, you know, confidence should come from a place of having privilege. But it was almost the opposite in the Caribbean, that I came from a working class background. I did not have very much. Therefore, I owed it to my parents who were making so many sacrifices to go out there and to be confident and to confidently take up my space in the world. So my teachers would say, you have to be this, you know, what are you going to be? I mean, they did limit it. You're either going to be a doctor or a lawyer, you know, choose one, which is, you know, that has its flaws. But it was made very clear that, you know, given my potential, given my academics, I had to choose a profession, you know, and when I slipped, you know, what has happened? This is what you said you wanted to do. What are you doing to achieve it? My church expected it. Everybody around me expected it. Everybody expected me to be successful. And the way I was humble, and there's a difference between you can have humility, but you can have a quiet confidence. So you can be humble and confident at the same time, confident in your abilities, confident the way you present yourself, but you don't have to be boastful about it, right? But I think here there's a misunderstanding almost that if you're confident that, you know, you're perhaps arrogant. And I've never seen it as that at all. And curiously, my son gets the same. You know, he is naturally confident, probably more confident than I was. And it's always remarked upon, you know, he's so confident as if it's a bad thing. Well, I want him to be confident. I want to raise my children to think that they are going to take up space in the world. And if anything, I think the right question is, why are we so tentative? Why are we so afraid? Why are we so afraid? And I've encountered, and I always use this example, I interview a lot of kids who come from private schools. And some of the kids from a minority background, they might go to the Winchesters, the Eatons, etc. And they do not come out with the same innate confidence that the other kids do. They do not present in quite the same way.
That's and interesting.
I sometimes wonder, is it because they've been told, you know, why are you so confident at an early age? Like my son is right now.
So I think we have to turn. And you're quite right. The question needs to be changed.
Turned on its head. Why are you so tentative? Why are you so afraid? You know, we should all be confident as women, as minorities, as, you know, as men even, right? As men, as black men, we should be walking in our confidence and proud to walk in our confidence. And that's what I aspire for everyone, for every working class child in the UK, everyone who's coming from a background that's not privileged. We should be raising confident little girls and boys.
I mean, completely agree. I think given your experience in training in the UK, training in the US, obviously coming from a completely different cultural context, you know, coming from the Caribbean as well, with, you know, all of the innate, as I say, that kind of sense of self from a very early age. Do you observe from a cultural perspective what you describe actually, I think, almost transcends race in the UK? Of course, we know that there are racial elements, but I think it's almost a class-based issue. From the perspective of how do we in the UK view people coming from certain socioeconomic groups and their entitlement to have a voice and their entitlement to have a seat at the table? And of course, race is overlays
exactly.
it as well.
And that's exactly it. Race overlays it all, but yeah. that's exactly it. And I think we tell, you know, we inadvertently or expressly do not expect the voices of those who don't belong to a certain set to be taking up quite so much space and to speak. So just, you may invite them to the table, but they're not expected to be loud.
Right. You know? Right. Yes.
Yeah. You know, so I think that is what we need to address, that, and that brings it into what true inclusion is, right? So that's why we cannot stop at diversity and picking out dots of people, one from a socioeconomic background, one from, you know, from this, from up north, one person from, you know, from the Caribbean, one person, and pretending that that is diversity, unless everyone is allowed to sit confidently and authentically in themselves and to bring their voices to the table and for those voices to be taken into account in the same way, then you're not going to achieve, or we're not going to get where we want to get to. So it's all part of the bigger equation, you know. Our voices should be loud. Our voices should be heard. Our voices should be amplified in the same way as others have been amplified for hundreds of years.
Right. I mean, I saw a brilliant meme that said something like diversity is being invited to the table, or being invited to the party, rather, and inclusion is being invited to dance. And I thought, that's just brilliant. Of course, I've got a vivid imagination. So, but you can actually, you, all of us will have had those experiences where you maybe stumble into a room, perhaps because you've been invited into that room, it might be a social function or whatever, and then you find yourself going, God, what am I doing here? Like, I feel so awkward. I feel so unincluded, uninvited. People that are asking me questions, it's clear that they view me as an alien. I feel like an alien, which brings me on to my next question, really, around how much of ourselves should we be revealing at work? You know, so when we talk about, you know, some of those previous generations.
The authenticity who, question. Yeah.
Right? You know, that some of those earlier generations, maybe our grandparents or our parents even, that maybe have moved from other countries to the UK. And actually, it doesn't have to just be people that have emigrated. It might be people that, exactly as you described, have moved from the north. Suddenly they live in the south. And, you know, that the way that they pronounce their vowels is being criticized. Whatever it is, that feeling of being othered. And those people, you know, I remember one of my friends at school, her mom is from Belfast and moved to London in the 70s or something at the height of the IRA bombings, and suffered terrible abuse from her fellow classmates, from people, just people up and down the tube. She had to, in order to survive in London, which was the city that she had chosen to live in, work and study, she had to disguise her accent on a day-to-day basis to the extent that it's almost completely erased now as a woman in her 60s. And so it makes me think, how much of ourselves can we and should we feel happy to reveal at work? Because we all are wearing different masks all of the time. You know, I wear a mask as a mother, then as a business owner, then as somebody that's from Birmingham and moved to London and then moved from London to somewhere else. You know, we're all wearing these masks all of the time. How do you know, you know, and it's exhausting.
Do you take
sometimes
it
you put the wrong mask on. Sometimes you go into a room and you're like, you stumble in and you're like, the mask is kind of crooked and you're like, oh, I put the wrong one on today. How do you know when it's okay? Should we be wearing those masks or should we just be taking them all off completely?
Well, I have been taking off my masks, I have to say. I started in the city, you know, not wearing my hair in the way I wanted to, not speaking in the way I wanted to. I still have a bit of a mongrel accent from, you know, just trying to hide. I remember the first day I was at Cambridge and my supervisor said, what? Whenever I opened my mouth, and I ended up trying to pronounce my vowels in a slightly different way. So now my accent is a little bit all over the place, but I make a concerted effort not to try to change it. It is what it is. But, you know, I've been pulling off a lot of masks, but I'm conscious that I'm doing it in a place of relative privilege because I'm a partner at a law firm, and maybe it probably was not possible for me to do that. I think one has to be the judge of how much of oneself one wants to reveal. I think it can be very naive to say go in as your full authentic self in places where they don't deserve it, quite frankly, because your authenticity can sometimes be used against you, you know, too loud, too much. So I'm very wary of advising people, you know, be in a very naive way to be their authentic self. I think I'm my best authentic professional self. The Akima that you see here is not the authentic Akima is here with you, but she's not going to be the same in Carnival. That's not the same genre of authenticity. So I think, you know, I'm all for, you know, I believe that I present authentically now, but I'm keenly aware that I'm in a space where I feel I can do that. So I don't judge anyone for holding back aspects of themselves, but I have to say, since I made a decision not to do that, I've been much happier personally. I feel like I've got opportunities that align with what I'd like to do, and I'm meeting people that I'd like to meet. So for me, it's been a win-win, but I'm just wary of telling people, be your authentic self at all costs, because I think the environment that you're in, is it an environment or an organization receptive to your authenticity, or is it one where you have to wear a mask to play a certain game? Now, I got tired of game playing, and I am who you see, I am who I am, and I've found organizations where I can be free to be who I am. But not everybody is in my situation. So I say that with a bit of, you know, care.
Yes.
That, you know, I would counsel people. I would say it's been the best decision for me, and I believe it's worked incredibly well. But I'm conscious that, you know, not all environments are created equal.
Akima, I love that response. It's such a well-considered response to that question, because I think it's so easy for those people, particularly those who've already overcome the hurdles, who have arrived, if you like, to say, be your authentic self.
I definitely haven't arrived.
Right? But, you know,
I'm becoming.
We are all becoming. But the thing is, we are all becoming all the time. But that's for those people who at least embodied the public emblems of success, certainly nobody could ever in a million years from any realm could suggest that you haven't achieved success. So to embody what is on paper, at least in Western culture, what success looks like, for you to then say, someone's kind of standing in a position of then recognizing that privilege and saying, be your authentic self, you know, that's what matters, you know, people by people and all of this. And all of those things, don't get me wrong, of course, there is merit to them. They are true. However, to get from point A to point B might require you not to dilute who you are or to become someone else, because that surely is a recipe for poor mental well-being. But just to recognize that you have to be a bit flexible and you have to be a bit agile. And so I really respect that response. You know, the fact that you say, you know, you're wary of telling anyone, go out into the world as your full, you know, go in your carnival costume on Dress Down Friday.
Exactly. You know, you know, it's a difficult environment sometimes for many of us. And, you know, particularly those of us who sit at the intersection of different identities. But, you know, having said that, I would encourage people to be brave. I think I wish I was a bit more brave. Some of the things I thought would have been huge impediments ended up being impediments that existed. They probably existed, but they were surmountable. So, for example, I thought my hair would be such a big impediment as a lawyer. And in fact, I think it wasn't as big an impediment as it was. And even if it is, I like the people who appreciate me for who I am, and I'm fine with that. If I've lost opportunities because of it, so be it. So again, I appreciate that I can say that now, but I would encourage people to be brave, to take bold steps if you feel that you can, and don't assume that being yourself would mean that everything is going to collapse or you're not going to get opportunities. I think you can talk yourself sometimes into these, you know, these circles. And again, as you say, compromise your own mental health. What it was important to me was to present in the fullness of who I was and then to see what happened. And if I lost opportunities, so be it. I was prepared to die on the altar of my of who I was, essentially. I think it has worked out well for me. But if anybody wants to have a chat about it, I'm more than happy to. I'm just conscious of, you know, the idea of saying I did it this way and therefore you should too. Everybody has a different story, a different path, a different environment, different challenges. So I think I just wanted to add a bit of nuance to that.
Mm. No, I appreciate that. So I suppose, you know, in thinking about DE&I as an industry, it's one that I have grappled with because, of course, from the perspective of being a Black woman and always being, you know, perhaps this is one of the things that I am particularly sensitive to, is the idea that you could be tokenized, you can be put into spaces to fill certain quotas, either real or imagined. And of course, what we've seen in the last 3 years, perhaps, has been a big explosion in DE&I as an industry, with the recruitment of a number of, you know, whole teams have been created, perhaps in a way that they didn't exist previously. Quite often there are prominent Black women put, you know, almost parachuted into very senior positions. I always say very senior, very visible positions within organizations to lead the charge when it comes to diversity, equity and inclusion. In many respects, that's a good thing. However, I reserve an element of caution around some of these appointments where I don't see the evidence of the follow through by companies. And actually, there is some great work being done by individuals running these teams and by companies. But equally, there is still lots of bad behaviour, I think, where this is concerned. And we've got, you know, on the flip side, you've got critics denouncing anything that even hints at DE&I is wokeism. I think the very word woke has been hijacked and, you know, it's become a bit of a misnomer for anything to do with this area. So I think there's a huge opportunity here. From my perspective, I feel like it should form part of the DNA of an organisation, but we recognise that in order for anything to be fixed, it has to be addressed. And in some respects, it has to be isolated, as this is the problem. We've got to treat it separately from everything else. But based on the work that you do, and even what you've experienced perhaps in different organisations, what do you see as the hallmarks of a successful strategy? So I suppose, you know, almost moving past these are all the problems, but what do you see? What does good look like? What would be some of the green flags for someone thinking about, I would like to join an organization in which I'm going to feel comfortable being my best self?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, inclusive leadership. So I think look at the leadership in the organization. Is it genuinely inclusive? I think that tells you a lot about the organization, how it sees itself, how it's wanting to position itself. And I don't mean, you know, tokenistic diversity, one woman, one white woman. I think, is it generally inclusive? You know, are people represented from different religions, class, racial background, racial composition, abilities? You know, is it a, you know, geographies even? Is it a generally inclusive? I mean, in law firms, you sometimes have all English partnerships. And I think you lose a bit of the international dimension if you don't have, you know, people from other offices, you're not interacting with others. So I think that's the first sign. That's the first green flag for me. You know, how inclusive is the leadership? At my own firm, I was very encouraged when the CEO was a man and was born in Cuba and grew up in Venezuela. I think that just gave him a bit of, you know, genuine empathy, you know, leadership skills in the middle of crises that, you know, a lot of people would not have been able to do. You know, he has been through a lot. He's familiar with the global South, and I think that is a definite edge. I think inclusive leadership. The second one is D&I strategy that focuses on experiences, not events. We see a lot of D&I panel here and there, an initiative here and there. Mentoring, as much as I love mentoring, you know, mentoring scheme here and there. Is your D&I strategy focused on really letting the organization live and breathe inclusion? Or is it narrowed to just a few pocketed silos, you know? Do you recruit inclusively? What about your recruiters? What do they look like? you know, when you're making purchasing decisions, when you're booking restaurants, what type of restaurants are you actually booking? When you're booking a leadership course or you're booking someone to come in, who are the speakers? So a lot of people pay lip service to diversity by having a few people in, but I don't want someone in on the odd occasion. I want people in every day who represent the diversity of, you know, this country and London in particular. And where it really sometimes falls down is the lack of attention. So you have a lot of people saying, come, 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 at the bottom end. And then at the top end, you have the leadership saying, yes, you know, we're great, we're amazing. But show me your middle managers. Show me the people that people are working with. How do they treat issues of inclusion? Do they come to events put on by the ERG groups? Are they managing in an inclusive way? How many people are on their team who are actually diverse? Are they giving those people good assignments? Are they keeping on? Are people who display diverse characteristics, are they staying or are they leaving? These are the metrics I would look at to really figure out whether a company is actually making a difference or making a splash. You know, a lot of people are making splashes, but we're not here for, you know, a good time. We're here for a long time. Those are just maybe a couple of things I would look at. I could be here all day talking about this.
But I mean, your point about the inclusive leadership, it's such an important indicator, isn't it? You know, what, because ultimately, with the best will in the world, even recognizing that, you know, you can join and make, of course, all of us as individuals, when you join an organization, you are joining because you hope to make a contribution. You want to add something of value. Of course, it's an exchange. And, you know, we're here to talk about the money because that's what Raincheck is all about, and making sure that women are getting an equal, or are being able to participate equally from an economic perspective. And that comes from building wealth. But looking at the leadership is really, really important. You know, to what extent do the purported values of an organization match with the leadership that represent that organization? So that, I think, would be the number one thing for me. And then moving on from D&I and thinking about, you know, some of your, how your understanding of different cultural contexts has influenced your relationship with money. And I wanted to talk in particular about the black tax. I suppose for people that are unfamiliar, I suppose, you know, we would need a definition of what the black tax is in your own words. But what did you learn about money growing up? What was your relationship with money like, and how has it evolved over time?
I have had, I think, varying relationships with money. I did not come from a background where I had tons of money. So when I started earning in the city, I thought, ooh, I'm very rich. But invariably, when you're from a working class background like mine, you know, you're expected, rather than, the dynamics are switched. So I think in the UK, you know, most people would probably get some money from their parents, you know, some form of inheritance or some assistance to buy a house. It's the other way around. If you come from a working class background, you're expected to send money home. So this has an effect on, you know, how you see your money. Your money is community property. Your money is not your money, right? Your money is meant to be invested back into, you know, your parents. For me, it was to buy my mom a nice house, which I was able to do before I even bought a house in the UK. And the effect on that, it can be compounded, because what if I had taken that money and bought a property in the first 2 years in the UK? I might have been exponentially richer. But just as a matter of culture and duty, we have those ties to our parents. And, you know, I did it with love and I'll do it again. But, you know, you do have to take care of the community. When one person makes it, you don't make it just for yourself. You make it for the community. So that's one thing you have to do. And then it doesn't just stop there. You know, your success is the community's success. So, you know, you would have something, your school needs something, you're the first person they call on, there's a raffle, you're the first person they call on, someone in your community needs shoes, you know, you're the first person they call on. So it doesn't stop at just your parents. You know, when you come from a small town community, you're expected to be a benefactor, essentially, even if, you know, you haven't accumulated. So the idea of accumulating wealth, it isn't really consonant with this idea of community wealth. Or, and maybe it is, but when I was much younger and I didn't have that much disposable income, there were two competing things, you know, saving for here, but also wanting to give back home. So that's, sometimes people call it as the black tax, but it's more of a thing, community investment. I would probably describe it best as a form of duty.
So it's almost like a return. The community is receiving a return on their investment in you, if you like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That invariably affects how much you can save. And, you know, as a migrant, it's not easy, because I remember, you know, we talked earlier on about, you know, when I moved to South London, I lived in Lewisham with my family when I came, and I really liked Dulwich. I really liked the feel of the area. I used to come down quite a lot when I lived just outside it. And when I was ready to buy, I'd saved up my deposit, you know, ready to buy my first flat in Dulwich. And they said, oh, well, you're an international student. You have to give us 20% or 10%. So I wasn't, a lot of loans were not eligible. I wasn't eligible for them. I didn't even know that. So then I had to buy a flat, a house in Catford, because that's the price point where the 10% that I could have afforded, where I could have afforded to buy a flat in Dulwich, that was 20% for a small house in Catford. But when you look at how property prices differentiated in the two areas, had I been able to buy that flat in Dulwich earlier on, I may have been able to benefit more from a price increase. So all of these decisions and all of these, you know, divisions that make, you know, the delayed saving of the deposit, because obviously invariably you're making your community investment. And then when you finally manage to save, as an outsider, as an immigrant, you're sometimes impeded from buying in the areas that make the most financial sense. So I think those two things definitely are things that affected people like me financially. I mean, I've managed to purchase what I want to purchase now, and I've managed to do what I want to do for my community and to be able to achieve some of my financial goals. But you do get an initial setback at the outset. And I'm seeing it now with new migrants, you know, people saying, well, I have to move out of London because I can't support my parents and support myself in London.
Thank you so much for sharing that so openly, because I think it's useful for us in this collective understanding of different, not even just different ethnicities, just different people and the different, you know, as you've said, you know, for some people, they may view it as a burden. For others, they are viewing it in the way that you do, more positively, and are viewing it on, well, this is the return that I am now, distributing to all those people that invested in me and in my community, so that the next generation of Akimas can, you know, be that safety net for the people that will come after her. But I think it is useful that we're able to discuss these issues, because I think actually there are probably a lot of people listening that would be completely unaware that this is even happening. And so when you're looking at things, you know, well, we all have the same opportunities and it's a level playing field, and that we all struggle together. We all have the same struggles, or we all have the same opportunities. And actually, whilst there may be some truth in it to some degree, actually the greater reality is that there are some people that may be, their start point is not the same. It's like that, again, there's a meme that shows, you know, a man and a woman, and the man is running straight at the finish line. There's no obstacles in his path. And the woman has got all of these things lobbed in there, a pram, a sink, like all of these random things that mean that she could easily be tripped up. It's a similar thing here when we're talking about people from different ethnic backgrounds and the contribution they are making to their communities back home at their own expense in some cases.
Yeah, and it's not just the Caribbean. I mean, it's very
absolutely
prevalent
not
in Africa.
Yeah,
parts of Asia too. And parts of Asia that, you know, you are expected to take care of your community and to take care of your family. It's definitely the difference between equity and equality.
Mm. So against that backdrop then, what does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you?
<That's>
and what does financial freedom look like for you? you know, because you've talked about, you know, being able to achieve your financial goals, notwithstanding all of the different, you know, actually carrying arguably a heavier load than someone else might carry who didn't have that responsibility for parents and family members and community, etc. So what would it mean for you? Are you quite conservative? Are you more free-spirited when it comes to money? What does it look like?
I look at money seriously as, you know, not something to be hoarded, that it's something to do good with. But having said that, you know, I recognize the power of money. And one of the shifts I've had to have with myself is how I view accumulating wealth. Because in my mind, it's almost antithetical to community building. It's, you know, I'm hoarding wealth. And I've had to change that because, you know, having enough and being able to provide for your family is very important. You can't do that if you don't have a mindset that, you know, you need it and it's something that you shouldn't shy away from. And, you know, I think I've becoming more and more incensed by things like the pay gap, where women are just being paid less. You know, sometimes I'm involved in conversations and discretionary pay, and I see that certain judgments have been made about women not being made in the same way as certain judgments are made about men, in necessarily the same way. So I'm always the person piping up to say, you know, we should be concerned about, you know, making sure that our judgments are always made with a view as to equity. And a big part of that is, for example, how we reward women. So a lot of women do D&I for free, to your point. A lot of women do pro bono for free. A lot of women do community building and mentoring for free. But so, for example, someone might be taking care of the billing on a client matter, and, you know, they'd get a big bonus for that. But why aren't we giving the woman, you know, I've been involved in various firms where the people who do sort of the soft work don't get, you know, compensated for it, but someone who would do, you know, additional work on a file, even though it's administrative work requiring less emotional intelligence and less labor, would actually get a bonus. So I think I've had a shift in that I am now prioritizing, and I say I've achieved my financial goals. I should clarify, say achieve my financial goals at that time. You know, I have new financial goals. I believe that one of them, sorry, is getting to a place where what does wealth mean to me? Being able to be, not worry. I don't have to have, you know, tons in my bank account, but I want to be able to know that my children's education is taken care of. I want to know I have good housing, and I want to make sure that I have a couple of alternative income streams as a hedge. So that's probably what wealth means to me, to be without undue worry about money and making sensible financial decisions that mean that I don't have to worry about it.
I loved what you said about your free-spiritedness around money and the fact that you don't believe it should be hoarded. I mean, we've talked before on this podcast about money scripts and, you know, some of the inherited beliefs we have around money. And, you know, one of those categories or avatars, if you like, is around those people that, you know, money is associated with status, or they're afraid of money, or they hoard cash because they're afraid, you know, they catastrophize in lots of ways. But actually, you know, when you described it being a source of good, potentially, and also kind of moving away from, which is really interesting and quite powerful, this idea that where previously you would have grappled with this idea that, you know, how can money be a force for good? You know, I've got to get rid of it as quickly as possible and make sure that it's invested within the community. But also money can be a source of joy, and it can enable me to achieve some of the objectives I have for myself, but also that some of those goals shift. So it's not a static thing. And it's one of the things we talk about all the time within the Rainmakers community. Sometimes the goals that you had as a young woman, they're completely different to the goals that you might have as an older woman. And that's okay, because as you said, we are becoming all of the time versus having arrived at any single destination.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I love the soft life, you know, I want the soft life. You know, yeah. I believe that is, you know, something that we should aspire to, where a previous generation of parents, they didn't have that luxury of even aspiring to them to a soft life. You know, they were always working, always busy, always saving, always scrimping, never buying the best for themselves, you know, always sacrificing. And it's something I've tried to shape myself. I do treat myself occasionally. I do not believe that life was created just to work and earn. And there's actually a saying in Grenada, when you say, someone will tell you, I wasn't born to work and die. That's it, you know. So I think you have to seek balance. And the balance is, you know, having a good money mindset, where we're not afraid to invest. We throw off all the generational trauma of constantly on the hustle and constantly scrimping, and try and project, you know, a life of abundance. And I think that abundance also extends, even if I don't have any money and someone asks me and they need it, I will give it to them because I believe the universe will give me back. And maybe that's naive, but never felt that I've wanted in that sense. And to it's a good thing that has followed me. But what I'm in the process of doing is, you know, really bedding down, particularly with, you know, mortgage, interest rates, you know, cost of living. It's just looking at my own spending, looking at my investment decisions and seeing whether they can actually be improved. And I think that's also a challenge for people like me. You know, you're busy, you're running around, and it's very easy to put yourself and your spending last, or to put any analysis of, you know, how you're doing things last, because you're just running from one thing to the next. But I think it's so important to make, not just to delegate to a financial advisor, but to really interrogate some of these decisions and to figure out for yourself, you know, what more can I be doing? No one's going to really tell you that and say, well, you're spending too much, or, you know, you're traveling too much, or, and now, for instance, you know, there's social media, which is another aspect. You know, everybody wants to be traveling, everybody wants to be going away on nice vacations, etc. Everybody wants to be having the dream house, the well-curated life. And that's something that you have to be resistant to, and living a life that you can afford and not necessarily the one that others have projected. Your partner, so you should be traveling business class. I don't travel business class with my kids. You know, you're a partner, so therefore you should be doing certain things. You should be having this house, or you should be doing this. You know, I try not to subscribe to that. As the song said, you know, you don't do things for the likes. You know, you do it because of what you should be the right thing to do. So I think that there's also that as well, particularly if, you know, you're seen as having achieved certain things. There's the expectation of what car you should be driving, what holidays you should be going on, what, you know, and it's very, very important not to get caught up in that hype and to actually make decisions that are consonant with the life that you aspire to in the long run.
I love that. It's the perfect place to conclude our conversation, Akima. I feel like I could talk to you all day, and there is so much that we didn't have time to get into, but I think absolutely, particularly your last point about the influence and the insidious effects of not even just social media. Of course, social media is a big one, but just other people and the expectations placed on our shoulders by other people, and how that can lead you astray, actually. And all of us, I'm sure, at some point, I certainly have succumbed to it in the past, you know, feeling like, you know, you work in the city, you work in a certain industry, there's millions or trillions of dollars being traded every day within the city, and feeling that you have to be a certain way, you have to look the part, you have to sound the part, you have to holiday in certain places, but just freeing yourself from the burden of the expectations placed on other people's shoulders. And it's something that women in particular can fall prey to. It doesn't mean that men don't, but I think freeing ourselves, liberating ourselves from those expectations is one of the best things that we can do, certainly for our financial well-being. So thank you so much for sharing all of your perspectives.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Where can people connect with you if they would like to? I would encourage anyone to follow Akima, at least on LinkedIn, so you can be privy to this microblogging series, as I say, which I love.
Thank you. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. You know, I'm on Instagram, but I usually just post family stuff there. So LinkedIn is really the best place.
Brilliant. Akima, thank you so much for your time today. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right. Take care and have a good day too.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.